Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Tony Wasilowski, senior correspondent here at RFERL. Thanks for joining me today, Tony.
Thanks for inviting me, Steve.
Okay, well, I wanted Tony to be the guest today because it's now been exactly 1 year since the presidential election in Belarus. And what a year it's been for Belarusians. After Alexander Lukashenko claimed a landslide victory in the vote, that was on August 9th, 2020, which many voters believe was rigged in his favor, they came out in large numbers to protest in Minsk, other cities around Belarus. And Lukashenko, who's been in power since 1994, cracked down hard in an attempt to make sure that he stays in power. A year later, this crackdown continues, and in some ways, it has even intensified. Tony, you've been reporting on Belarus and following the situation closely. Your story out this weekend on our website addressed some of the things that have changed in Belarus since the election a year ago, some certainly for the worst, but some... arguably for the best. Could you tell us one or a few of your main takeaways from this year in Belarus and what that might mean as the country enters year two of what I think might accurately be called a new era?
Sure. Definitely Belarusians who dared to raise their voice against Alexander Lukashenko and his decades-long rule have paid a very severe price. NGOs, something that were always, you know, targeted under Lukashenko's regime, have faced even harsher measures, including this one group that I wanted to highlight, Vyasna, arguably the country's leading NGO, which we journalists have turned to over and over again to document much of the abuses Belarusians have faced during the current clampdown. You know, they've kept numbers of those being detained, numbers facing trial. So in March, they were charged with activities that disrupt public order. Mm-hmm. And along those lines, just this in July, there were these huge raids, not only on NGOs like Vyasna, who had their offices raided, but also what's left of independent media. So we had these huge sweeping raids and arrests of journalists and independent media, including Nasha Niva, which is one of the country's oldest and most popular newspapers. Its offices were raided, were targeted in these raids, as were the offices of RFERL's Belarusian service. So, you know, NGOs and independent media have really been decimated over the past year. Just another couple of examples. Euronews was taken off the air in April as its license was not renewed. And Belsat, which is based in Poland and is one of the few actually media organizations that actually broadcast in the Belarusian language, mm-hmm. was just labeled as extremist at the end of July by a court in Minsk. So it's been really, you know, Lukashenko has really cracked down hard. He's changed some laws that make it almost a crime for journalists to report unsanctioned rallies, and to get a rally sanctioned has become harder too because he's changed laws on mass gatherings as well. This is all in April this year. So he's really, this is all tied to the opposition under Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya was hoping that they would kind of regain momentum, kind of lost over the winter, mm-hmm. and they were hoping for the protest movement to kind of get started again at the end of March, what they were going to tie to the anniversary of the first short-lived Belarusian independent republic. That didn't happen. And I think, you know, Lukashenko has done everything within his means to make sure they don't regain any momentum that was lost over the winter.
Yeah, and it seems like as you're describing, you know, last year or last summer, you know, the crackdown was more focused on, you know, the protesters, people who were protesting the elections, and then going into this spring, kind of still cracking down on protesters as their numbers dwindled, but also going after the media, after NGOs, you know, even harder, and also changing laws to make everything, you know, harder to come out and demonstrate.
Definitely, and especially this this case with Roman Protasevich and the diversion of this Ryanair flight that was on a flight from Athens to Vilnius in May, being diverted to Minsk. I think for Lukashenko was a very extreme measure that raised alarms across Europe and the world. So he was willing to hunt down his enemies, even in the air. And then there's this recent case of this death of Vital Shisho, who was found hanged in a park in Kiev, who fled Belarus last year and was helping those fleeing persecution. One of his associates told our current time that Ukrainian intelligence believes that Belarus sent hit squads to Ukraine to hunt him down. So this is all very disturbing.
Right.
So, on the other hand, there's some hopeful signs that, I'm talking to analysts over the years, the fact that never before have, Belarusians themselves ever been so kind of united and willing to express their views. I mean, for years they've been, Lukashenko is clamped down on any kind of independent media or given them, any voice. And they found the bravery, the fortitude to resist that. So there's kind of this, at least a revival maybe in the language, especially amongst young people, to look into their past, their non-Soviet past. I was talking to the British historian Norman Davies, and he mentioned that one of the main elements of this current protest movement is this search by Belarusians to find, to re-examine, to rediscover their own past, pre-Soviet past.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of, I guess, glimmers of hope. And I mean, it seems, with this crackdown and the effects it's having, it's hard to see what's going to happen, going forward. You mentioned the Protasevich case, his detention, other things. This podcast is called The Week Ahead in Russia, and Russia has certainly played a role in the events of the past year in Belarus. An example is the kind of support that Russia has given Lukashenko following these actions, such as Protasevich's arrest on when that Ryan airplane was forced down in May. In my newsletter last Friday, I recalled that just after the election 1 year ago, when what had been big campaign rallies for Lukashenko's opponent Tsikhanouskaya, who you mentioned, those campaign rallies kind of turned into even bigger protests over the official results, which millions of Belarusians simply did not believe. Tsikhanouskaya officially got about 10%, and Lukashenko, I don't remember, but maybe 70 or 80%. So, that after the big campaign rallies and just outpouring of support for Tsikhanouskaya during the campaign, those official results seemed unbelievable. Particularly after previous elections and referendums in which the Western observers never always said that they fell short of being free or fair or democratic. I think Russia's reaction at the beginning, how Russia would respond, was not really entirely clear. But Tony, tell us a bit about how the Kremlin has reacted since, in the years since, and whether its approach is likely to change as time passes.
Sure. You're right. It was unclear how the Kremlin would react, because actually months going into the election, the relationships had cooled again because Lukashenko wasn't caving to Moscow demands on closer integration on a union treaty.
Right.
Interesting enough, in February, Mike Pompeo, who was then Secretary of State, had made the first visit by that such a high-ranking official to Minsk in decades. Then a month later, the United States was making a first oil shipment to Belarus. So there was a warming, actually, of ties with the West, cooling with Moscow. And at the time of the election, Lukashenko was accusing Moscow of sending mercenaries, Wagner mercenaries, to cause chaos around the time of the vote. After the vote, everything changed. And now today we see Russia has extended $1.5 billion in loans to Belarus. So they're very much tied to them. This April, when Putin was giving his address, he mentioned this this coup plot that Lukashenko has played up and basically gave backing to this. And just days before the national address on April 24th, Russia sent back to Belarus Alexander Feduta, a former Lukashenko spokesman who had joined the opposition, and lawyer Yoris Zvankovich, who has dual Belarusian U.S. citizenship. So Moscow, which in the early days was calling for compromise and also pushing Lukashenko to make amendments to the constitution to seek some type of peaceful resolution of the crisis, has to completely jettison that type of talk. They completely back him, and I think part of the reason is that Putin's own problems at home, which all kind of seem to really kind of accelerate when Alexei Navalny returned from Germany, and you had these protests that the Kremlin cracked down, and now the Kremlin has its own crackdown on media and NGOs there. So any type of talk about Belarus should seek some type of peaceful resolution with his opponents would something that would suit Kremlin interests right now. So I think going further, obviously Lukashenko is not an ideal candidate, but in his weakened state, it's perfect for the Kremlin. They can extract more concessions from him vis-a-vis this union deal. And coming next month in September, they're going to be holding again the Zapad military drills, and partially in Belarus. In the meantime, both militaries have been even further integrated. They've talked about forming some type of new brigades together and stuff. So Moscow's definitely been using this weakened state of Lukashenko to try to really squeeze as much advantage from this situation as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a good analysis. I mean, I agree at the beginning, it was unclear what Moscow would do. And, there was talk about would Russia support someone else, a different candidate, kind of ease Lukashenko out, ease someone else in who would be both popular and credible to the Belarusian people, but also, would have good relations at least with Moscow. And obviously that nothing like that happened, and as you say, Russia has thrown its support behind Lukashenko, at least for now, certainly for now, and seems to be betting on him for at least some time, but at the same time exacting kind of concessions or maneuvering to increase its influence over him and over Belarus. So it's obviously a very difficult situation, kind of hard to predict what will happen going into this the second year after the election there.
Definitely. I think at one point they were talking about Viktor Babarika, who had managed the Russian-owned Belgazprom Bank as being a possible candidate that the Kremlin would find amenable. But he's just been sentenced at the end of July to 14 years imprisonment on embezzlement charges that nobody believes are credible. He was seen as actually the most serious challenger to Lukashenko. He was kept off the ballot. Obviously, he was arrested just before the vote last year.
Yeah, and I mean, there were analysts talking about, well, this could be, a chance for Russia and the West to kind of collaborate to some degree on creating or helping usher in a new era in Belarus. But obviously, what's happened instead is that the situation in Belarus, and as you said, in part because of the situation in Russia, I think. The situation in Belarus has become, even more of a wedge between Russia and the West. Okay, well, we're running out of time. We'll wrap it up there. Tony, thanks a lot for joining me.
It's nice to be with you.
All right, great to have you. I'll be back next Monday for the next edition. Meanwhile, please watch for my Week in Russia newsletter this Friday. Thanks for listening.